Edmund White described Robert Coover as a one-man big bang of exploding creative force. Salman Rushdie praised his almost alarming linguistic energy, and T.C. Boyles dubbed him our foremost verbal wizard. Mr. Coover is the author of several volumes of short fiction, many novels. His latest book, A Child Again, retells the tales of Little Red Riding Hood, the Pied Piper, and many others. It is published by McSweeney's, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Robert Coover to the show. Hello.
How do you do?
One critic said of your version of Pinocchio in an earlier book, the New York Times being a family newspaper, little is quotable. Doesn't that hold just as true this time?
Well, it's not. They're not, I suppose, exactly the versions that children learned when they were reading the stories the first time. But I've always thought of myself as being something of a realist inside the different forms I use, and that language is real, and the topics discussed are real.
So I can't really give a synopsis of your version of Snow White without getting into trouble with the FCC. But since you've been doing this for a while, I assume you feel fairy tales have something to say to adults.
Well, they certainly have had something to say in the course of their upbringing. That one of the things that I was most interested in when I first began as a writer was thinking about the ways in which stories that we were told or somehow were delivered to us over our childhood and beyond come to, in some respects, tyrannize us, or at least we stop questioning them, that we just accept them, and then we retell them to our children.
But we tell them differently at different times. Historically, fairy tales would often have horrific elements, like Snow White's sisters cutting off their toes to fit their shoes. You can't imagine Disney putting that detail into his version of Snow White.
No, but those are important aspects of it. It shouldn't be forgotten either. The Grimm brothers' stories are still told, and that's when the sisters do what they do to themselves. That's also when Snow White and her Prince Charming, to celebrate their wedding, invite the stepmother to the ball and put red-hot iron shoes on her and let her dance herself to death for the entertainment of the guests. So, in fact, that's part of my Snow White story.
So is it important to reexamine our childhood archetypes?
That's the important thing. And not only childhood archetypes we keep inventing for ourselves from day to day by way of television, popular media, and so on. And that's kind of because those stories go enter into our consciousness without being thought of as stories, in a sense. They become like our natural environment. That's the sort of space I like to work, rethinking all of that.
It's been pointed out that your heroes are all defeated in their post-histories. Is that one of the things got you started, asking what happened after Happily Ever After?
Yes, of course. I mean, Happily Ever After is one of the myths, but it isn't just that they're defeated. What I find in them, we're all defeated. We all come to the unhappily ever after ending. But what is admirable, I think, and what is most human, is the struggle against that destiny, a struggle against the forces that we will in the end beat us. But so most of my heroes are actually standing up even as they're getting knocked down, sort of like any good pratfall comedian.
Well, are these stories really about getting older? The title, after all, is A Child Again.
This set tended to emerge that way because early stories such as Alice suffering menopause and still stuck in Wonderland, these were thoughts I had that made me think back on the stories from an old person's viewpoint, or old Sir John Paper reconfronting his old friend Puff. I think, though, that the book itself is designed to be on children's themes and children's literature from a lot of angles. So we have puzzle pages and riddles, and we have stories that are actually kind of happy moments in less happy stories. So
you even have a deck of cards that is attached to the back of the book. What's that all about?
Well, that's a little shuffleable story. It's because it's based on the heart suit in a deck of cards. That's what its title is. There are the 13 cards of the suit plus a opening card and then a joker with which you end the deck. And you can shuffle all the middle cards in any order and read them. And it's like a lot of my fiction. It's not only about the story, but it's about the form itself.
And as one person who figured it out points out, you have 6,227,000 20,800 possible stories made out of a simple tale. Only Raymond Queneau, 100 trillion poems, outdoes you.
Yeah, well, that's
in the world. So how do you go about writing something that can be read more than a billion different ways?
Well, the fact is, as with Queneau's poem, it's a 14-line sonnet with 10 variations in each line. And the truth is, you can't, it take, I think, three human lifetimes just to read each possible version. But if you read the 140 lines and think of them as mathematical sets, you have the whole poem. And in a certain way, a shuffleable story is similar. Once you've acquired the materials of it, then the rest of the possibilities are clear to you.
But you call yourself a realist.
Yes.
Others have called you an experimental writer, a postmodernist.
Well, realists can be experimental. I learned my realism, I have to say, from Kafka. So,
the true realism. Mm-hmm. Is it important what version of the story, the fairy tales you choose to retell? I'm thinking about Anthony Burgess's review of Pinocchio in Venice. Mm-hmm. And he said that you view the Walt Disney film of Pinocchio as a realpolitik fable.
Well, of course, the film there is only part of it. The character Pinocchio himself is returned to his homeland to finish his last great opus. He's turning back to wood again. He knows he's dying. And the reason he's returning home from America is that he went over to America to film the biography of his life, to be the consultant on the Disney film, so to speak. So the film plays a kind of fantasy role in his realistic life, you might say.
Robert Coover has been writing wonderful fiction since 1966, when his first novel, The Origin of the Brutus, won the William Faulkner Award. His other works include Prick Songs and Descants. There is The Public Burning, which was nominated for a National Book Award. But also, you were teaching electronic literature before there were PCs, weren't you?
Oh, yes.
How is that possible?
Well, because...
With those big old computers?
No. I started on one, actually. But by the time I was doing this, it was in the late 80s, early 90s, what we did have were hypertext authoring systems that worked on floppies and minimal sort of memory systems on university computers. And it just simply graduated from that early stage of limited hypertext into what we now call literary hypermedia because of the internet.
Does that also allow for the sort of thing that you did with the tale of the cards here? That there are any number of different possible narratives?
Yes. In fact, when you credited me with being second to Queneau, I'm not sure that's true. If you look out on the internet, we may see sort of infinite possibilities out there in hypertextual works. But it was something that I was thinking about before I started teaching hypertext, and hypertext just reinforced some of the notions that I had already as a writer.
You said that as we leave behind printed text, we enter into problems about the impact of literature, the way in which we get absorbed by literature, and the page-turning mechanism.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's only the first thing. The first thing that any student learns when they get into electronic literature, they leave the page-turning mechanism behind.
And some of them don't mind in the least. Isn't there pretty much a generational divide here? Last night, I was at an event honoring P.D. James, and her speech was pretty much, "I am appalled by Bill Gates's claim that." That in a very short time, we will no longer be buying books. We'll be reading everything on the computer. There's something comforting about having a book in your pocket and turning those pages and the smell of the ink, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes, absolutely. And that little passion will always remain. And all of us who work in the electronic medium do read books. I think that would be an unwise claim of Gates. What is certainly true, though, is that the digital world is changing. The digital revolution is changing absolutely everything about the way we communicate. And it does make the use of books very different. A lot of books certainly no longer are sold as books. They now are on encyclopedias, for example, things like that. So it's just a question of how much interest there will be, whether there will be readers out there to support a somewhat flagging industry in print literature.
Well, there are most older people say that they can't look at a screen long enough to read a book. Younger readers seem to prefer the computer screen to a book. Older people read newspapers. Younger people go to the internet.
Yes, they sometimes don't know exactly what a book is. You have to show them how the page turns.
Do you think it's going to change the way we read and the way perhaps even our brains are wired?
It will do, and it can do anyway. I still love the book, man. That's what I write. As you know, we're talking about
books. Yeah, well, we have a book right here from McSweeney's and not a computer whatever program.
And I love the experience of being lost in books, which is not as easy an experience to achieve in any extended way in any computer interactive activity. So my guess is that there will always be people interested in reading. One thing I must say, the internet has facilitated access to books in a way that readers are popping up in places in certainly in this country and I suppose the world where they never had access to books before, except perhaps at the public library, which is a censored list. And now they can, you know, go to any of the online companies, draw down the books, and read things that only I'd heard about before.
You have been doing variations on fairy tales for a long time now. You have Little Red Riding Hood here, where the protagonist is fascinated by her grandmother's nose, for example. Publishers Weekly says your Alice in the Time of the Jabberwock is more absurd than the original Alice in Wonderland. Are you going to run out of text to do this with?
Well, that's not all I do.
I know. You're an essayist.
Well, no, I mean, it's not the only theme I use. The world is just throws things at you every day. And so, you know, the Brunus was about a fundamentalist cult, and I'm now working on a sequel to the Brunus. I mean, they never stop throwing things at you.
And that goes all the way back to 1968, so they stay with you all this time.
Even beyond, I was writing it in 1968. So, yes, and the public burning, of course, was not a fairy tale. It was a real political event. And I would say that for example, Lucky Pierre, which is the last book out about a pornographic film hero, that's sort of more like a folk tale, I suppose, but it's not
it's another version of Pinocchio. We all understand that. Robert Coover's latest book is a collection of short stories called A Child Again, and it is published by McSweeney's. I want to thank you so much for being with us
today. You're welcome. Thank you very much.